Hello everyone, and welcome to the History of England, episode 339, A Scandal in Bohemia. It is said by the wise and noble that James's reign can sort of be divided into two. To be honest, if you are going to divvy up the cake that is James VI and I into two parts, there are a number of ways you might do it. In Scotland, you might argue that James left the land of the free, a successful monarch in 1603, but died in 1625, leaving significant problems for his lad to inherit, particularly in concerns over becoming a province of England and in the Five Articles of Perth and the religious direction. If we're talking about James I, you might think about a different division. Up to 1618-ish, give or take, James had done a pretty good job, really. The church had its tensions, as, you know, churches frequently do, you know, the early modern equivalent of who's doing the flowers this week. But there was very little separatism, and James had maintained a nice balance between the opposing wings of Puritanism on the one hand and Arminianism on the other. He had his barnies with Parliament, but was holding the line. Finances were bad, it's true, but Cranfield was already having an impact, and, most importantly of all, the land was at peace. So, James could pat himself on the back that things were going okay, and after all, being king was, you know, a reasonably high-powered job. But after 1618, things start going awry. Finances begin to get seriously out of whack. A gap appears between the views and policies of the king and those of his people, and for once this matters, because there's much more of a public forum in which to discuss this stuff, which formerly had been completely out of the ken of ordinary folk, except when they were, you know, asked to die for it, periodically, which they generally did, happily enough. Obviously, the reason for heading pearwards are many and various, and fear not, gentle listener, we will spend some time talking it all through and picking over the bones of Jacobean England. However, I would also advance another contributor to the forthcoming tussles, which is the physical condition of the main decision-maker here, our hero, Jimmy 1 and 6. Because although the 50s are the new 20s these days, or at least they are for this podcast, a spry, live, performance athlete, stunningly good-looking, all of that, in 1618, they really weren't. In terms of age, the 50s were in fact the new 80s, and James, age 52, was showing some of the signs of wear and tear, as you do. I remember Bilbo Baggins at the age of 11-1 saying that he felt like butter scraped thinly over bread, and James was probably feeling worse than that. He suffered from gout, he had kidney problems, bad circulation and arthritis. He was a bit feeble in the leg area, had to be carried to his chair at Parliament, and he often had bronchitis. He drank too much, if there is such a thing, and since he'd lost most of his teeth, he bolted his food without chewing it, because, as Albert's Lion Wallace found out, you couldn't chew Ladonc gums. Bit of Stanley Holloway there for you oldies. Maybe this physical decline coloured James's attitude, you have to wonder, though it is nonetheless clear that he didn't make like Edward III and lose his mental faculties, he remained intellectually pretty sharp. You might think age and the physical stages of bits dropping off would make him more and more dependent on his favourite George Villiers, now Marquis of Buckingham. And James was most certainly smitten with this beautiful young man and lean on him mightily. But just to follow through on the Edward III analogy, Buckingham does not become James's Alice Perrers. James makes the decisions. James retains the ability to put his paramour right when he disagrees with him. However, by 1620, things had got to the stage where no courtier could hope to prosper without Buckingham's goodwill. That doesn't mean he always got his way. For example, in 1619, James chose his own candidate as Secretary of State against Buckingham's nominee. In 1621, the same thing happened with the Chief Justice of Common Pleas. And if a Buckingham candidate did get the job, but messed up, then Buckingham's protection would not keep them from the chop, such as was the case for a certain John Norton, forced to resign in 1623 by the king, ending effectively his political career. But where the king had no very strong opinion about a new appointment, then he usually accepted Buckingham's choice. And Buckingham could also block or subvert ideas for new appointments if your face really didn't fit into his vision. So, Buckingham's tentacles insinuated themselves throughout government in the form of his expanding clientage. Now, you might want to avail yourself of the sick bag that I know many of you keep by the ironing board, especially for when you listen to the History of England, because I'm going to give you an example of the kind of language grateful recipients of favour tended to use. In 1619, Buckingham managed to wangle a 1,200 quid grant for his client, Francis Bacon. Bacon, despite being a very influential statesman and politician all on his own, and a natural philosopher of lasting legacy, tended to be constantly short of a bob or two, and so he was very grateful, and he told Buckingham so. "My affection may and doth daily receive addition, but cannot, nor never could, receive alteration." And again, when James mentioned some good things his Steenie had relayed about Francis, Bacon wrote to Buckingham tearfully, "I can but be yours, and desire to better myself, that I may be more of worth to such an owner." All a little vomit-inducing, but it's worth noting that this was, to a degree, just the form, the way it was. Just like those florid formal letter sign-offs we used to use in the dim and distant when we still wrote letters to each other. You know, "I remain, madam, your most humble and obedient servant, and pray that all the felicitations of this season hover on your brow." That sort of thing. And clientage brought with it obligations from both sides, not just from the client. The client was expected to deliver and to listen to his patron's desires and advice. In return, Buckingham was noted for his consistent courtesy to all and, to the extent of which he was capable, his loyalty and constant support. Now the whole system seems very corrupt and dirty to the modern eye. Buckingham profited vastly from the favour of the king. When he arrived at court, as you may remember, he had nothing more than 50 quid a year, was spotted at the races in a holy black gown, that's a relic in physical terms rather than religious, and carried a pencil he'd half-inched from his time at school as pencil monitor. By 1620, with the lands, honours, grants and jobs he'd accumulated from his grateful king, he was turning over an income of 18,500 quid a year. Now, I had a look on the National Archives currency converter, which is a lot of fun, by the way, and in modern terms, that's 2.5 million quid a year. In 1620, that could buy you 10,000 cows every year, which is more than enough, surely, to keep you in beef and horseradish sandwiches. Nor was this largesse limited to George. He was assiduous in making sure his family profited to boot. So, his brother Kit, for example, would become Earl of Anglesey, despite being, in George's own words, little deserving. Another brother, Edward Villiers, gained various diplomatic roles. John Villiers became Viscount Purbeck. His sister Susan Villiers had married William Field, and George engineered him into the role of Master of the King's Wardrobe. There were also marriages he brokered. The worst story is probably that of John Villiers' bride, Frances Cook, and here I have to crave your indulgence for a digression into a potted history of Frances Cook, because I probably won't have a chance to get back to her. So, the sad and tragic story of Frances Cook. In 1617, Buckingham and Edward Cook, you know, that Edward Cook, the famous jurist, put their heads together and cooked up, the idea that Cook's daughter Frances, 13 years old, should marry the 26-year-old John Villiers, Buckingham's brother. Now, for Edward Cook, this would probably and hopefully get his career back over the political shoals he'd hit through an alliance with the most influential man in the country. For Buckingham, on the other hand, Frances Cook stood to inherit a pile, and John was mentally ill, so George was keen to see him married happily. Frances and her mother, Elizabeth Cecil, were not keen on the plan, however. Not keen on the plan one little bit. They fought the idea tooth and they fought the idea nail. So Mum removed Frances from the Cook household and hid her with her relatives. But Dad found her, put a posse together, broke down the doors and took her away and housed her with his relatives, the Yelvertons. During the process, he had his daughter whipped to get to agree to the marriage. Still, Mum and daughter resisted and put the case before James, who duly ruled that her father's rights were absolute. Ha, the patriarchy. All a bit hideous. And Frances was then forced to marry at a sumptuous event at Hampton Court in front of the king. John Villiers, on his part, did his best to be gallant. "I would have been pleased to have taken her in a smock," he said. Ben Jonson praised her beauty in a play which she was at the time, by the way. One of the gypsies in the play says, "Never yet did gypsy trace smoother lines in hands or face. Venus here doth Saturn move, that you should be the queen of Louvre." Assuming love needs to be done Louvre for the rhyme, you know? I must admit, I'd quite like to be in the audience when somebody described me as a looker in a play. Don't think it's going to happen, but there is time yet. The story gets worse. As John Villiers' condition got worse, the pair separated, and Buckingham took the opportunity to take possession of Frances' £10,000 dowry, meanwhile keeping Frances in penury, until he was forced to cough up an annual stipend for her by James. Then Frances had an affair with a man called Robert Howard, gave birth in secret to a child they called Robert Wright. Frances swore blind the child was actually John Villiers' son, which he patently wasn't, and they were both found guilty of adultery. Howard was excommunicated. Frances was to do public penance, which involved standing in a public place, dressed in white, barefoot, pronouncing her guilt. Frances was having none of it. She remained loudly defiant in court, yelling at the judges that they should make their own wives set the good example by swearing that they were free from all faults. This is 1627, so Frances was 25 by this time. Well, she flatly refused to do her penance, and with the help of the ambassador of Savoy, managed to escape to France dressed as a page boy. By 1634, both Buckingham and Edward Cook were dead, so Frances returned to London to be with Robert Howard, which is sweet, love's young dream and all. Sadly, Charles I was no more forgiving. Into jail she went, only, would you believe it, to escape back to France again. Robert Howard then jumped ship and joined her in France, where they both converted to Catholicism so as to be acceptable at the French court of Louis XIII. Still, she was pursued from England, and now she had no money to live on, so she and Robert lived in relative penury. In 1640, they both returned again to England, and she died in 1645 in Oxford at the King's Court there during the Civil Wars. Her son fought for the King's side, and his descendants would start a long, long court case that went on till 1774 to try and recover their fortune, at which time the line finally died out. Well, there's a story for you. The author Joanna Luffman concludes that while a victim, Frances undoubtedly contributed to her own problems with her pride, but surely here is an incredibly resilient fighter for her own rights, with all of society arrayed against her. And while she was in Paris, an English observer was outraged by her exile and complimented her on her prudence, sweetness, goodness, honour and bravery. At least, she found a partner in Robert Howard who stuck with her through thick and thin, which is something, I suppose. Anyway, where were we? Ah yes, we were talking about Villiers and nest feathering. Just to complete the story then, Buckingham also delivered other ways of enriching the family. All of them managed to get various monopolies, and we'll talk about monopolies in just a moment. So, now that I've blackened Buckingham's name to the modern ear, though I should once more stress there is nothing unusual about any of this, either in English history or indeed European history. Let me talk a bit more about what Buckingham actually did and his motivation, apart from enriching himself and his family. The point I'm going to make is that Buckingham, just like Cecil before him, might have enriched his family, but he also felt a keen sense of obligation to his king, to his country, and to the concept of public service. He was not just there to rake in the cash. One of Buckingham's earliest mentors was Francis Bacon, a very famous and in many ways impressive man on whom I should write more, but forgive me again, I will try to give you a bit more about the man as an example of the more attractive attitudes of England's rulers. Bacon intellectually is an interesting mix of the traditional and the forward-looking. Hopefully we'll get a chance to look at his natural philosophy sometime, but he was an early example of a man who expected the future to be different, a future driven by humans' discovery of how the world works, as opposed to the Aristotelian view that the universe was set, understood, and driven by a set of established principles, the view that had driven the medieval world and scholasticism. And even the Renaissance view was that all we had to do was rediscover the wisdom of the ancients, not discover new truths. Possibly that's a controversial statement, don't know, discuss. Anyway, while Bacon was therefore in some ways radical in his natural philosophy, he was deeply traditional in holding views that Thomas More would have recognised as far as public service was concerned. He believed in active citizenship, that his responsibility as an educated man was to advise his monarch on the best course of action. He owed it to serve his country, to serve his church, Bacon was a convinced Anglican, and to uncover knowledge for the good of mankind. He was an advocate of the king's powers and prerogative, but within a balanced constitution. The king's sovereignty and the liberty of Parliament are as the two elements and principles of this estate, which do not cross or destroy one the other, but they strengthen and maintain the one the other. We have seen his defence of the rights of ordinary people in his Act of 1597 to protect livelihoods from enclosure, just as Thomas More and Thomas Wolsey had tried to do before him, and his view that treasure and monies in a state be not gathered into few hands. Money is like muck, not good except it be spread. Bacon indeed came from a family dedicated to public service and to Protestantism. His father Nicholas Bacon had been a close associate of William Cecil and Lord Keeper of the Seal under Elizabeth. His mother Anne Cook had been a powerful intellect in her own right, a tireless advocate of Protestantism also, translated John Jewell's works into English, and we have letters from her to Francis talking about matters of government and church and urging him to be a good man. Francis clearly admired his mother and asked to be buried next to her when he died. My point is that Bacon saw public service as a duty, very much in the Renaissance tradition. And Bacon communicated this view to Buckingham when Villiers was his young protege at court before he rose to power. So he reminded Buckingham that it is the life of an ox or beast, always to eat and never to exercise, but men are born, and specially Christian men, not to cram in their fortunes, but to exercise their virtues. He advised that Villiers should dedicate himself to the public and countenance and encourage and advance able men and virtuous men and meriting men. Buckingham held this advice close and followed it. He felt a deep sense of personal obligation to the king who had enriched him so much, to his country and to his class, and its responsibility to serve. In 1619, he rose still further in the political firmament, replacing the old warhorse, the Earl of Nottingham, as Lord Admiral. And he wrote when he did so, "Being obliged far above others, by His Majesty's most gracious favour and trust in this principal charge, I thought it the best account I could give of the first fruits of my labour, out of former ill manners, to beget some good laws, by which the government of the ships may hereafter be settled, and the governors and others contained in their duties." So Buckingham became immensely rich, and in enriching his family would cause resentment and, in some cases, make very poor decisions. But his motivations were much more complex and more public-spirited than his failures and acquisition of wealth might imply. And a first example that Buckingham could be effective lay in his early job as Lord Admiral. He did not treat it as a sinecure. He inherited a naval service that had become inefficient and riddled with corruption. Nottingham might have been a war hero, but his administration wasn't his jam. Buckingham was determined to change practices and appointed as commissioners for the Navy one John Cook, another example of a hard-working, conscientious public servant, although on a dramatically different scale of income. He was pleased when he got an appointment that gave him an income of 300 quid. Cook was a family man, close, strong and long relationship with his wife Mary. He was an industrious and honourable, if possibly rather dull sort of bloke, who declared that public service was a stage to do good and vowed not to dispose of my life for wages. And he did have a talent for administration, and under his care, the Navy halved its costs and began to meet the objective of producing two new ships every year, the first being launched in front of the King in July 1619. Cook's work was also part of Lionel Cranfield's work to try and get the King's finances under some sort of control, reduce spending, increase income, so that James could fulfil his lifelong and noble ambition to never call another Parliament as long as he lived, because Parliaments were way, way too lippy. Trouble is, of course, that James's financial incontinence didn't help. Poor old Lionel, he had a job on. By the end of 1618, the King's debt had risen to 900,000 quid, despite all that rummaging around down the back of the sofa, impositions and so on. Cranfield and Buckingham were allies in this. And you really have to be impressed, actually, with Cranfield's relentless and slightly tiring optimism. Positive people can be so difficult to deal with, don't you think? Cranfield urged Buckingham not to despair. No, not so much as be discouraged. For the more desperate the King's estate is presented, the more honour will be to rectify it, and the more shall be your lordship merit of His Majesty to be that happy instrument to do it. Impressively positive. And Cranfield was pretty effective, actually, while facing this impossible task. He reduced household expenditure by 18,000 quid a year. He cut expenditure in the royal wardrobe by 8,000 quid. He increased customs dues, including on the new trade in tobacco from Virginia, incidentally. And he had some successes. By 1620, he'd reduced the debt to 712,000. And there was actually a surplus on the ordinary account of 45,000 quid a year. Gold star, Lionel, sir. Please, pass go, collect 200 quid. Not that James really put himself out to help. As an effective way of not saving costs, he commissioned the banqueting house in Whitehall Palace to stage grand events and entertainments, as well as to host formal dinners. The absence of such a venue in the Palace of Whitehall was actually a bit of an oddity in European terms, but Henry VIII had always preferred to set up temporary, purpose-built structures instead. Anyway, Inigo Jones was appointed to build it, and he finished by 1622, but of course, it cost a bob or two. James's daughter and son-in-law, Charles and Henrietta, would also love masks, and Charles commissioned Peter Paul Rubens to paint the ceiling of the banqueting hall in 1636, which was nice, because Charles then got to look at something lovely as he walked through the hall on his way to his execution in 1649. James also shelled out in a major way in March 1619, for a funeral for his wife Queen Anne, who died at Hampton Court that year. The funeral apparently cost twice that which was spent on Elizabeth I's funeral. Maybe this was guilt. James had paid increasingly little attention to Anne with the arrival of Buckingham and visited her only three times in her final illness. Unlike her son Charles, who frequently slept on her floor to be near her. The funeral was a grand affair, with over 1,300 mourners and a host of foreign dignitaries. Anne's hearse proudly displayed the motto Beati Pacifici, blessed are the peacemakers, although I am told makers of dairy products also got mentioned. And James's use of the term would become significant because things were about to flare up in Bohemia and were threatening to drag James's kingdom into the abyss. Over the next few years, James would resolutely play the role of peacemaker. He did this against the background of something of a negative feeling among some at court. Anne's death very much emphasised James's fondness and reliance on his male favourites. There was a general air of decay, as far as some were concerned, of worrying accommodation with Catholicism, of corruption. The Venetian ambassador, Piero Contarini, felt there was a general lack of esteem for the Stuart dynasty at this time. The people were pining for the glory days of Elizabeth. He reported back home that he had heard great lords deplore the present state of affairs with bitter tears and complain that England, which once stood high in the world, had now forgotten her past glories and almost fallen into oblivion of herself. What then, I hear you ask? What had happened in Bohemia? Although you probably all know, actually, given that you'll have heard from the episodes in this parish about the 30 Years' War. We are heading, gentle listeners, towards another defenestration, a fine and honourable tradition in Prague, which is rather nice, because when you look up the topic on Wikipedia, you get a page which is in the plural, defenestrations, rather than simply defenestration. Are there, I wonder, any locations that can compete with Prague in the history of defenestration? Answers on a postcard and all that. But let's go over it just one more time again. First, just to remind you about the Habsburg family. Although once upon a time, Charles V had ruled all the Habsburg lands from Spain and Germany, he'd split up the job as being too big for one person. And so now we have two branches, the King of Spain, currently Philip III until 1621, and the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, Ferdinand II. This is important, because although in theory the Spanish Empire and the Holy Roman Empire were two different entities, getting them to take each other on was something of a long shot, and in practice, they wore the same strip, they sat in the same stands at the match on a Saturday afternoon. The largely Protestant Bohemians did not much like their new king, Ferdinand. He had two faults in their view. Firstly, he tried to reverse many of what they believed to be their secular privileges and freedoms. Secondly, he intended to restore all of the empire's lands back to Catholicism. If there had been a ballot box available, this would have earned him a cross in the Chad, if I remember that age-old discussion of pregnant Chads from years ago, or indeed, it might have earned him a spoilt ballot paper. Duly and rebelliously, in August 1619, the Estates deposed Ferdinand, a bold move, and 4 days later, they offered the throne to a sprig of a 23-year-old, Frederick V, Elector of the Palatinate of the Rhine. This was even more bold. This also had direct relevance to James and to England for 4 reasons, really. Firstly, there's a general one of the struggle between Catholicism and Protestantism, which many in England and more widely in Europe saw in a carefully balanced and moderate way as an eternal struggle between good and evil in the millennial tradition. This, by the way, has nothing to do with the design and manufacture of hats, but with the second coming of Christ and the establishment of a 1,000-year rule of saints before the Last Judgment. Secondly, it was a question of what's important in life, war or peace, to boil it down. James, bless his cotton socks, well, probably bless his woolly hose, felt that it was peace. Those piners after the glory days and fervent Protestants thought this was the wrong choice. This will be a continuing matter for increasingly vitriolic public debate. Thirdly, there's the issue of monarchy and its status. Now this falls slap bang into the heart of the resistance theory debate. That idea, which had its supporters in both Protestant and Catholic circles, by the way, that if a monarch didn't do right by religion for his people, it was meet, right, and our bounden duty to chuck him out on their ear. James had no truck with such a concept as far as he was concerned, if her people were unfortunate enough to have a tyrant as a king, all that they could do was bow their heads, pray, suck it up, and sit it out. Although monarchs should do their best to rule well in the interests of their people, they were ultimately responsible only to their employer and boss, otherwise known as God. So, the removal of Ferdinand was viewed in a different way depending on where you stood on that particular debate. The last reason, though, was probably more immediate in 1619. Frederick V of the Palatinate was family. Because as you might remember, in February 1613, Frederick had married James's daughter Elizabeth, to general rejoicing among his relieved subjects. Relieved because it hadn't been long since it looked as though James might be considering an alliance with his heir Henry to the Catholic Spanish, which would of course been an abomination as far as many Protestants of the hotter sort were concerned. So, this was personal. As far as James was concerned also, personal was exactly the word we are talking here. There were matters of policy that a monarch was obliged to discuss and consult on with his people. Reluctantly, James agreed this included some, though not all, public subsidies. But foreign affairs? Oh, no, people in Parliament, you just keep your sticky little fingers off that one. This is big boy and big girl stuff. This is a matter for monarchs, not for the perusal of the people or for comment from the commons. Keep your noses out. Well, that nose would soon be out of joint. There was a further factor here, since I would like to avoid saying, and fifthly, which was that James was once again eyeing the idea of a mariage between the houses of Stuart and Habsburg, this time between Charles and the Spanish Infanta, Maria Anna. Obviously, it would be a glorious union, but also there was an issue of money. One way of avoiding the need to summon the Lippi to London for another parliament was to remove the need to touch them for a few quid, and the Spanish had deep pockets and might stump up a decent dowry and help the happy father live in the way to which he was accustomed without all that parliamentary faff. Negotiations had been dragging on about this since 1616, dragging at least in part because Charles was 18 but Maria Anna was a tender 12 years old. So there didn't seem to be a terrible hurry. The Spanish ambassador, Diego Sarmiento de Acuña, first Count of Gondomar, who shall henceforth be known as Gondomar, had established a good relationship with Buckingham, and negotiations usually involved Buckingham as well. It became a trope of all of this that James was a puppet dancing on Gondomar's string, but in fact this doesn't seem to have been the case. James was actually a pretty slippery customer and a negotiator, and Gondomar viewed him as an incorrigible heretic anyway, and deeply untrustworthy. Frederick and Elizabeth then gave the offer of the crown from Bohemia some serious consideration. They wrote to James for his advice, as it happens, as also did Elizabeth to the Archbishop of Canterbury, George Abbott. George saw the whole thing less as a matter of subtle policy and the balance of power and rights of monarchs, and more in terms of, well, the apocalypse. The kings of the earth that have their power unto the beast shall now tear the whore and make her desolate. On the other hand, the diplomatic professionals thought rather differently. The English ambassador in Brussels, William Trumbull, worried that Frederick might be so badly advised as to accept the dignity, which will bring him a cruel and almost eternal war. Well, when George Abbott wasn't frothing at the mouth, he rather cunningly advised Elizabeth not to ask Dad until they'd decided. He knew full well what James's view would be, namely, that you can't go around stealing crowns from anointed monarchs and handing them out like prizes at a fairground, coconut shy. But he reckoned that when presented with a fait accompli, James would be forced to take a different family view. So, before he could have expected a response from James, Frederick accepted the offer and he and Elizabeth set off for Prague and their shiny new crown. James was furious. He agreed entirely with the Trumbull view of life, not the Abbott version. His son-in-law was participating in rebellion and would start a quarrel, as he said, that would never be ended. I'm not going to tell you that James is wrong, to be honest. And that, gentle listener, is all we have time for this week. I am trying to pick up the speed a bit because I have been a bit indolent in 2022 so far, so there will be another episode next week. And then I have a guest episode, which is a bit of a personal indulgence. Sorry in advance about that. Now, I also have an important announcement for members. Honourable members, I am pleased to announce the History of England mobile app. Ta-da! The aim of this humble offering is twofold. Firstly, and primarily, so that you can find your way around the shedcasts more easily. There is so much on the feed now, over 85 hours of shedcast, all on one feed, and it's a bit difficult to see the wood for the trees without going to the website to use the tools there. The other reason is that you can access the History of England and History in Technicolor episodes without any adverts. To find and download the app, you cannot sadly go to the App Store, but it works for both Android and iOS. Just go to thehistoryofengland.co.uk, log in with your normal membership details. Then you will see a menu option appear on the horizontal black menu bar on the homepage, which says Mobile App. Click on that, use the QR code to download to your phone. When my sister invited me to see her at university many decades ago, she made sure to describe to all her friends just what a plonker her little brother was, so that they would feel slightly positive when they found out that, although I was a bit of a unit, I wasn't that bad really. This is a strategy that has always impressed me. Set realistic expectations. Gentle listener, we are not app developers. This is not a general podcatcher where you can download all your podcasts into one place, get notifications and all that. You can only access mine. It won't send you alerts, it won't make the tea in the morning, but it is a great way of doing those two things I described. Easily finding and listening to members' shedcasts and listening to the free podcasts without any ads on them. So I commend it to you. Also, my lad has made a short, helpful video about downloading and using it, which I will post on the website to boot. So, hie thee to thehistoryofengland.co.uk, log in, and then select the mobile app menu option. Sorry for all that, everyone. Thanks for listening. Good luck, and have a great week.